In this episode of Unmuted Africa, I wanted to find an inspiration, a hero. It's 2020 and it's election year in America. Behind all of the politicking, campaign and primary noise, I found an exemplary woman actually making democracy happen. That's Kat Calvin. She is the founder and executive director of Spread the Vote and the co-founder and CEO of Project ID Action Fund. She's a lawyer, activist, and social entrepreneur. She has built a national organization that helps Americans obtain the IDs they need for jobs, housing, and life, and that also allows them to go to the polls. Along with Spread the Vote and Project ID, Kat co-hosts Vote the Podcast.
She's an advisor to Ragtag and Demcast, and she also sits on the boards of the California Women's List and OMG WTF. She's one of Time Magazine's 16 people in groups fighting for a more equal America, 2018 Fast Company 100 Most Creative People in Business, and she has been a Business Insider 30 Under 30. She has been recognized by BET's PBS and many other. Here at Kat Calvin. Kat Calvin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So in 2013, the Supreme Court essentially gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act. What does it say to you about American democracy?
Well, I mean, I think an important thing to understand about American democracy is that this is a country in which, unless you are a white man who owns property, you've had to fight for your right to vote. Like, this is a country in which everybody has had to fight for the right to vote over and over and over again. Most notably Black Americans and Black women, because we had to get two amendments to be able to vote. So it's not surprising at all. It's why we needed the Voting Rights Act. I think it's very clearly why we still need a Voting Rights Act, is because this is a country, and it's not unusual. People in power want to stay in power. In order to do that, you need the same old people voting, because they're going to keep voting for the same person. And you don't want new people voting and young people voting, because they're going to vote for somebody different. And so the people in power in this country, like in many, but more effectively here than most places, do everything they can to prevent people from voting, because that needs change, and they don't want change.
For quite a few years now, you decided to do something about it, helping people to get IDs, the IDs they need to vote.
Yes. So America, we don't have a national ID here like most countries do. We have 50 states, so it's difficult to do federal things like that. There's no sort of state ID that everyone gets either. And so we have over 21 million just eligible voters, far more people, if you look at people who are not eligible to vote, who don't have photo ID. So I started Spread the Vote to help people get that ID.
Okay, so you've been around the country to help people to get IDs and vote. How different was it from state to state?
So the rules are fairly standardized at DMVs. You need a birth certificate or some sort of proof of birth, which can vary if you're, for instance, not born in the US. You need proofs of identity, proofs of address, proofs of social security, things like that. And the number of documents for each that you need may change. But it's one thing that is pretty similar across the country. There are things that are different. Like, for instance, it is so hard to get a birth certificate or an ID in New York. It's really hard. California makes it kind of hard, where they're, Virginia actually makes it a little easier to get a birth certificate, things like that. So there are states where getting a particular type of document may be a challenge, or where, we're in West Virginia, where there are only like 7 DMVs in the whole state. So you have to travel a lot further in Virginia to get a DMV than, we have more than 7 DMVs just here in LA. And so there are differences in access, differences in how hard it is to get certain types of documents, but the rules for getting an ID at the DMV are pretty closely standardized around the country.
Do you coordinate with other organizations?
Oh, absolutely. So we work, we have well over 100 partners at this point. So we work both with some national groups on different issues and statewide groups, but the partnerships that we really work closely with are local partners. So in every community where we get IDs, we work with shelters, food banks, churches, schools, prisons, jails, et cetera. So to everybody who serves the same group of people that we serve, who need IDs. and who they are helping in their own way, whether it be providing a bed for a night or food or helping with job placement or whatever, but they can't necessarily help with the ID that they need. So we partner very closely with local organizations everywhere that we work.
All these new voter ID laws come from Republican-controlled states, red states. Do you get any help from the Democratic Party?
No, the Democratic Party hasn't done much at all in anything, but particularly in the voter ID space. There are a lot of organizations that mostly like ours are nonpartisan. I'm the ACLU, the Brennan Center, and the League of Women Voters, who have sought sort of judicial remedies. They've had a lot of lawsuits, things like that, which these laws are very hard to fight, so they're not usually successful. One thing that the Democratic Party has done is they introduced a bill in the House called HR1. They're now thinking about renaming it after John Lewis, which is basically a renewal of the Voting Rights Act, but updated to include some things like curbing corporate giving after the Citizen United case and things like that. It's in the House. It has absolutely no chance of passing the Senate while McConnell is in charge. We'll see what happens after November. But I think that party has shown that, if there is some political will, then this is the HR1 may get passed. Other than that, though, like the party itself isn't doing a lot to fight or address voter ID laws.
You've been doing this for years, but today we live in a different world because of COVID-19. How has it impacted your mission?
A lot. I mean, I had to ground my staff and volunteers in March, which we did pretty early. As soon as I realized that this thing called COVID was here, and it was really scary. And then shelters and food banks started to have to shut down their volunteer programs, and DMVs around the country shut down. So we've worked on getting virtual IDs. So pretty much every state kept their online DMV services open. So if we had someone who needed to renew an ID or do one of the few things you could do online, then we were still doing that. But it really, we work totally in person. We're in shelters every day. We go into prisons, we go into schools, we go into all these things, and we couldn't do that anymore. It's really disrupted our work. We've gotten pretty good at virtual work, but our numbers are, of course, just much, much, much smaller than they would have been. We also now have an issue because DMVs are reopening, but they're mostly appointment only, and getting an appointment is very difficult. So we can't get an appointment at the DMV in Michigan until November.
Right.
So now we're at a point where we're able to help some more of our clients. We're trying, I've still grounded all of our volunteers and staff, but we're trying to find safe ways to help our clients get to the DMV, but it's still a slower process. It still means we have to work virtually with a group of folks who don't have a lot of access to the internet or phone even. And so it has put a real block into our work.
In some state, like at least in rural areas where DMV is not closed, I mean, what strategies do you use? How do you get people to get the IDs they need to vote?
Yeah, so more than 10 million Americans live more than 10 miles from a DMV. And like you said, a lot of that is rural areas. A lot of that is places where there is no good public transportation. So we do everything from, our volunteers and staff will drive people and give them rides. We will often work, if we work with shelters or someplace that have a bus, they may just bring a busload of folks. There are times when we have to Uber or Lyft, or we'll buy someone a bus pass. It really, depending on, we're in so many different cities and states that every situation is different. We're lucky we've got, we work with a great organization in Nashville, and they happen to be just a couple blocks from the DMV, so people can just walk over, which is really convenient. Yeah. So we try to manage and help with the transportation in whatever way makes the most sense for the area we're in.
Cool. After years of doing this, I'm assuming you have tried different strategies, different tactics and whatnot. Have you gotten any pushback, say, from some local government?
Well, we were once banned from a Memphis DMV by a petty bureaucrat, but that didn't last long. You know, for the most part, it's funny because we're really just following the rules. You know, we really go into a place and we're like, hey, you wanted voter ID laws. We're just helping people get IDs. I'm not printing these IDs in my basement. You know, like, we're right. taking people
that
to
would
DMV.
Be bad. Yeah.
I mean, I wish I could, but I can't. So right. we're taking people to the DMV. And then they're deciding whether or not these folks can get an ID. You know, like we're literally just following the rules. We may be following the rules better than you planned on us following them, but we're following them to so people can, you know, fulfill a requirement you wanted. And so it really takes the wind out of the sails of a lot of people who would criticize us because it's not me making the IDs or making the decisions or trying to get around a law. I'm just following the law.
Anything you have tried that has failed, that you say, okay, this really doesn't work. This is not how you're going to get people to be involved.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, so when we first started, we were in Georgia, and I thought, oh, well, we'll just go around with folks who are canvassing for, you know, nonpartisan issues and knock on people's door and just say, hey, do you have ID? And that was so ridiculously dumb because it's a very personal question and yeah. it's a scary question. Yeah. And you have some random person knocking on the door and asking if you have ID. We had a lot of people like run away or slam the door on us or whatever before we realized, oh, this, there's no trust. And this requires a lot of trust because people are, you know, first of all, just admitting you don't have ID can be dangerous because even though it's not illegal not to have ID, cops will put you in jail anyways. And then we're asking people for a lot of very personal information and a yep. lot of time. You know, it takes an average of 3 to 4 weeks to help someone get an ID. You know, a lot of faith in us to help them with this. And so just knocking on the door or like giving someone a flyer at a bus stop is not going to do it. And so we realized that pretty quickly. We scared some people, embarrassed ourselves. And so that's when we started partnering with these local organizations that already had these relationships but couldn't help their clients or community get ID. And so when they said, hey, this organization's here, they want to help you get an ID. Then, you know, the very first time we tried it, we had a line around the building before we could set up our computers.
Wow.
Because as soon as people realized that you could be trusted, then this is something people desperately need help with. People just need to know that you're safe.
You have a background in law. Like, what really pushed you to just quit and say, this is my calling today?
Well, first of all, being a lawyer is super boring. And
Okay.
And so I took the bar and I was like, I'm done with that. And I've always been an entrepreneur. So that, like, that's just who I am. But I think for me, like what I've always wanted and tried to do is find ways to make a measurable impact, primarily in the Black community and then the larger community. My particular skill is seeing a problem that no one else is addressing, or at least maybe not addressing at scale or in a certain way, and then finding a solution for that. And so after the 2016 election, you know, I had been paying attention to voter ID laws, which had really started to grow around the country after the 2013 Supreme Court decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act. And it was just really clear that judicial remedies weren't working to get rid of voter ID laws, that certainly lobbying politicians wasn't working. And so I just sort of thought, well, then let's just get people the IDs they need. Which is a lot harder than it sounds, but it seemed like the solution that would lead to the best way to help as many people as possible who don't have IDs get to the polls.
Lately, but not just lately, it's been happening forever. The killing of Black folks by the police. Does that trigger, does it boost a bit people's involvement?
You know what's interesting? It hadn't before. But we, during the George Floyd protests, yeah. We got hundreds of new volunteers. I think it's a combination of, you know, sort of one of the same reasons that these protests have been able to go on for so long. Nobody's working right now. So people have time. It's during an election year, so people are really fired up. But also, like, that was the triggering event that led to so much national attention for the first time. I mean, the fact that anybody in this country who is not Black was, like, celebrating or aware of Juneteenth still blows my mind, because I never thought that was going to happen. And so there just has been this real shift. And so we did see this time a lot of people try to volunteer that were, like, directly said that it was because they had either been part of or seen the protests and wanted to do something.
Yeah. As far as volunteering goes, how does it work? Who gets involved? Is it diverse?
No. So actually, it is mostly elderly white ladies, because we take people to the DMV, right? We need people, the bulk of our volunteers need to be people who can go to the DMV or vital records when it's open, right? Which is 9 to 5 on a weekday. So we get a lot of amazing retirees who have time during the day.
Yeah.
Or a lot of, you know, sort of stay at home moms whose kids are in high school. And so they can go to the DMV at 3 p.m. on a Tuesday, you know, when the rest of us are working, which has been really amazing to see, because I didn't know what that would look like. But given those sort of parameters of work, and then we get a lot of other, you know, volunteers who fit other demographics who can do sort of evening work or weekend things or whatever. But the biggest percentage of our volunteers are people who don't have to work during the day. Which has been really cool, because we also get a lot of like retired teachers or social workers, you know, people who really get this work, and who have the time, which has been really nice.
With Spread the Vote, do you get involved in the political? Do you educate people on issues?
So we're nonpartisan. We have to be as a C3. What we do is we make election guides. So 77% of our clients have never voted before. So we do a lot of sort of beginning voter education work. So we make our own election guides for every state that we're in every year. Which covers a lot of basics, like, how do I vote? Where do I vote? What are my rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act? Like, what are, you know, what can I ask? This and that. And then we break down not just who's running for office, but what office are they running for and what does that office do? You know, because most people don't know, like, what the Board of Supervisors does, et cetera. So we try to make it a very approachable guide for people who've never voted before. And we've got folks, you know, I think midterms, we had, you know, everyone from 18-year-olds to, I think, the person who was oldest who had never voted before was 79. Wow. So it really, you know, runs the gamut. And so we do a lot of voter education, and then, you know, a lot of just like helping folks actually get to the polls. And, you know, we keep it nonpartisan. We did just start a 501c4, which can be a little more partisan and do some lobbying and candidate work and things like that.
Okay.
But Spread the Vote is just, you know, we try to just do as much basic voter education and things that will help people be able to go to the polls and really feel empowered and feel like they know what they're doing.
Yeah. And then the way you guys work, it's not seasonal, it's always ongoing. But where do you decide to put resources, whether it's human resources or just funds, to register people?
So, you know, we work with a very specific population, because we're only working with people, for the most part, who don't have IDs, right? Yeah. So it's 11% of the population. It's, you know, the majority of folks are unemployed because you can't work without an ID. Many are experiencing homelessness, returning citizens, et cetera. And so we have a very narrow lens about who we're working for. And then within that, about 80% of our clients are eligible to vote. You know, we work a lot with, you know, some different prison systems and things like that. So we do work with people who are not eligible to vote, or we help, you know, folks who are undocumented get IDs, et cetera. But about 80% of the folks we work with are eligible. And so one of the things we do with 91% of our eligible clients is we register them to vote most of the time when we're getting them an ID. So that's an ongoing thing that we just always do. We always ask, you know, about 9% of the folks we work with say, I don't want to register, but most folks do. So that we do year round. And then around June, and every year is an election year, but so, you know, some years only like Virginia, Kentucky, and Louisiana have big elections, and you know, then other years, everybody does. So around June, is when we start planning, you know, well, and until this year, we sort of had gotten into a groove about what elections looked like. This year, everything's just gone to hell. But, you know, around June, we really start planning. We have an amazing researcher on our team. She works on voter guides all year. But we really start planning, what is our get out the votes, you know, system going to look like? Who are we partnering with? How does this work, et cetera? And then, around September, our volunteers and staff start doing a lot of outreach. You know, we only 1% of our clients have regular access to a phone. So it takes us usually several months to get back in touch with everyone, you know, and we go to the same places, you know, we'll go to the same shelter every Thursday or something like that. So we actually are able to build and maintain relationships with a lot of our clients, but it's also a very transient population. And so we spend a lot of time finding as many of our clients as we can, saying, hey, it's election time. We told you we were going to get in touch. We're having, you know, a voter party at this shelter or community center or whatever. Bring your family. We'll have food. We'll go through and make a voting plan. And then those usually happen in October so that we can, depending on the state we're in, either make plans to take people to vote on election day, or if we're in a state that has early voting, then we can also take them through early voting. So the election cycle is usually sort of late summer through fall.
Yeah. So one thing I noticed with you, just reading and researching, is you don't get tired, because COVID-19 is stopping everybody. You started a podcast to still educate people. How do you find even the energy and the time to do all that?
I understand how important these things are. And yeah. So like we're doing a lot right now. I'm actually always tired. That's actually my secret. I'm always tired. But I also we take breaks. So, you know, I make my staff have a mandatory 2-week vacation after the election, and then I will be taking a vacation. So, you know, part of it is knowing, like, it's a very sort of work hard, play hard, like, look, the next 100 days are going to be horrible and exhausting, and we're going to want to die. I'm going to hate everything. We're probably going to yell at each other sometimes because we're so stressed out. But all we have to do is get through the election and a couple days after, and then everyone's going to have a break. And then we'll be in the, you know, December, January, February will be really chill. So partially it's knowing, and everyone who works in the election sphere, that's how it works, is you just know, you know, yeah. July, August through November, your life is just going to be a total nightmare, but that's what you signed up for. This is the job. And then afterwards you get out of it, you know, but I do a lot of, like, I run a lot and, you know, I do a lot of things. I constantly will have some sort of TV show on in the background. I drink a lot of bourbon. Like, you know, I also find ways to sort of chill. I have distance hiking with my friends on weekends. Yeah. And so, yeah, there's, yeah. I try to do a lot of things in between to not work and not think.
Looking back, can you see anything that prepared you for this moment?
My family very much raised me to believe that the whole reason that I have all the privileges that I had growing up was that I had to spend my life trying to make the Black community better. So that was a message I got. I was the oldest. I don't know if any of the other kids got that message, but I did. And okay. So like that was always understood. It's like this, I wish that they had said, you have to go to Wall Street and make a lot of money. They didn't say that. I'll never forgive them for that. But what they did say is like, look, this is our country and this is the state we're in. And it's your responsibility to do something about that. So I think that had a lot to do with how I grew up. You know, I also, you know, I spent a lot of my youth in Seattle in the 90s, where, you know, Seattle is a city full of entrepreneurs, and especially in the 90s. And so everywhere we went and in school, you were always learning about entrepreneurship and you were always learning about starting your own business. And we all knew about, you know, Steve Jobs and Boeing and you know, all of these things. And so, you know, I always had a real sense of what it meant to sort of be your own boss and to start a business and be an entrepreneur. And that made a lot of sense to me. And I was in theater, and I love to produce and direct, which is basically just starting a business over and over and over again. Right. Theater really, I learned very, very young that I could, you know, build a whole world and tell people what to do, and they had to do it. And then the whole world had to see what I wanted them to see. And that's very empowering for a very young girl. So it's like, oh, I mean, being a director is being a dictator. So I loved it. I love being a dictator. So, you know, I think all of those things really added up to you know, and then just having a lot of different job experiences just really added up to me sort of being whatever this person is.
That's a great story. You don't just dream, you actually execute on it. Who inspires you?
I have a lot. I mean, my grandmother certainly, is an extraordinary woman. When it comes to business, so the woman named Veuve Clicquot, Barbe Nicole Clicquot Poncedon, she was a 29-year-old single mother during Napoleon's rise, and she by herself built one of the most famed and lasting champagne houses of all time. And she did it with a lot of courage and a lot of audacity. And I've always really just completely admired her. I think there are a lot of people, mostly women in history, because usually when you learn the real story about men in history, you're like, oh, you were terrible.
We've been running the world for long. So
exactly. It's like, oh,
this too long.
There are a lot, I went to a women's college founded by Mary Lyon, who I always grew up just learning about and how extraordinary she was. And, the things that she did to start a college as a woman in the 19th century. And so I think there are just a lot of different people who I always grew up learning about. And I have a mother who went to a women's college in the 70s. So my entire childhood was just learning about strong, powerful women throughout history. Okay. It never occurred to me that I couldn't do any of those things. Cause Mae Jemison was a huge hero of mine when I was a kid. And it's like, oh, anybody could be an astronaut. Like, this is the thing you can do. You could do whatever you want. You can do it. Cause we've been to space, we've started businesses, we've already done everything. So
It takes one.
And I always wanted to be the first, which I think is a thing that you learn too, being in a place where entrepreneurship is really celebrated, is that I love that Mae Jemison was the first woman in space. At that age, I didn't want to go to space. I do now, but at that age I didn't, but I wanted to be the first to do something, and so it wasn't so much, if you can see it, you can be it like, oh, this Black woman was an astronaut, so I can be an astronaut. It was like, she was the first and she was a pioneer and I want to do something like that too.
I just want to get back into democracy in general in America. Are you hopeful looking at all these things that Black people are going through? Do you see anything that's going to trigger real change?
Well, I mean, there's a two-part answer, because first of all change is incremental, right? Like, we're not going to change anything overnight. Our entire system was built to change things as slowly as possible, and it will always be two steps forward, one step back. Right now we've got two people running for president. One will probably result in the end of the world, but one will just be a really big step back, right? Like, it's not, neither of them are great. But I think that right now, and it's funny because I am not a hopeful person at all, but it's very difficult to see the world and see where we are right now and not see hope. I think the Juneteenth example is a huge one. Juneteenth has been a big deal in my family forever. I have never heard the words Juneteenth come out of a white person's mouth. And all of a sudden, like, Visa is doing commercials about it. Like, it blew my family all day on Juneteenth, kept texting each other being like, what is happening? What parallel universe am I in? People are talking about Juneteenth on TV. And so I think that, and then you have, the 1619 project. And, thank God for smartphones, because we've been trying to tell people that we're out here dying for 200 years, and they finally get it. But it's not just that. It's all the small things. It's all of the, this white woman is calling the police on me because I'm in a park asking her to leash her dog, right? Or I'm just having a barbecue. And it's all of these things that we've all been telling people have been happening to us for, our whole life. And no one believed it. But now when it's on camera and on social media and in the news over and over and over and over again, people are starting to realize, and white people are starting to realize, like, oh shit, this is happening all the time. Why is this happening all the time? And we can be like, I tried to tell you. And so I think that we're at a point where most people, and there's always going to be people you can't change, but like most people, they finally see, hey, racism's still a thing. We've been trying to tell y'all, there's a reason that we're terrified of the police, right? And every time you tell us, oh, it's fine, calm down, it's not, and it never has been, and like they finally get it, and they finally, like, they're finally realizing that the history that they've been told was a total lie, and that there's so much they don't know. They're finally understanding like how Hollywood has been just completely whitewashed forever, right? And so I think that like I've seen awakenings in so many people, you know, and we have these volunteers who are these amazing, like lovely older white ladies who, you know, start off not, you know, knowing a Black person. And weeks later, they're stuffing a bunch of returning citizens from a homeless shelter in their van and taking them to the DMV and then buying them lunch and then texting with them all the time and telling me, oh, George got a job and blah, 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 you know? And like, and they totally change. And then they realize, and then, you know, they will frequently say to me, George told me about why he went to jail and it just wasn't fair. I'm like, it's America.
That's right.
Realizing it, and then they get so dedicated and so into it and like really understand. And so I think that we are now at a point, and particularly, you know, the Gen Z confounds me. I'm an old, I don't understand them at all, but they seem awesome and they seem to like understand what's going on in the world.
Yeah, and I both.
And I'm just like, look, I don't understand what you're doing, but you seem to have the right idea. And so I just, you know, I think that we're going to see what happens on November 4th. And right now it could really go either way. But there has been an awakening of people in this country that they can't go back, right? Like white people are not going to go back to forgetting George Floyd's death or here, right? Like they're never going to forget that. They're not going to forget how many times a Becky has called the police on someone for just living their lives. And that is really changing things.
Yeah. No, it's that's true. Thank God for the internet and smartphones. I think you're quite generous on that. My take on it is people knew. We got to a point where people cannot just look away anymore.
I think some people knew, but honestly, a lot didn't. You know, it's funny because I think it was a couple of weeks ago that the NFL or someone said that they were going to start playing Lift Every Voice and Sing. And every white person on the internet was like, there's a Black national anthem.
Yeah.
First song I learned, right? But like, there literally is, you know, we just have this whole culture, this whole world. And, you know, Black Twitter is great. Once, you know, Black Twitter did a whole day of like Black artists, you know, that white people have never heard of. Like, we have a bunch of singers who we love and we listen to at every family event. You have no idea they exist, right? You have no idea that there's a Black national anthem. They're just, we really do have this. You've never heard of Juneteenth. And so, you know, it is, I think that most people really didn't know like the everyday racism and the microaggressions and that, and how often police shootings happen, right? Or, you know, there was just an article in the Washington Post about how Black homeowners, even if their homes are owned in white neighborhoods, are almost always taxed at far higher rates.
Wow.
Right? Like, same neighborhood, same zip code, house next door. But when the surveyors survey their houses, they will survey us at a much higher rate than the white families. So even when you finally buy that house, you're still getting screwed. But the thing is, those things are finally making it into the paper.
Yeah.
You know, like white people are finally starting to be like, have you ever heard of redlining? Like, I've heard of redlining, right? But they just don't know. Like, they just found out about the Tulsa massacre because of Watchmen, you know?
Yeah.
And so I really think that for most people, they just didn't know. And they didn't know the extent of it and the depth of it, yeah. You know, which is why I think when we've been arguing for affirmative action, and then they've been like, why? It's fine. Actually, so on our podcast this week, we have Harvey Levin in an interview, and he's the founder of TMZ. And he has recently like had this whole revelation. And he said something amazing on the podcast because he said, you know, I always heard people talk about reparations and I didn't understand why they wanted like payment for something that happened 200 years ago. And he said, but now I understand reparations isn't about what happened during slavery. Reparations is about what happened this morning. They're finally understanding that we're not talking about what happened during. Everyone gets, you know, a day of slavery in school, and then you learn about how great and peaceful Martin Luther King was, you know, and then that's all you learn. Yeah. And, you know, even so, there are a lot of Black Americans who don't know a lot of our history. You know, I come from a long line of very educated, angry women. And so I was taught all sorts of stuff. I knew who Angela Davis was like day one, right? Like, you know, but there are so many folks who didn't learn a lot about Black history. And I'm constantly learning new things because there's just this depth and there's so much, and you do not learn about it in school at all. at all.
Thank you so much. This was great.
This conversation continues on Twitter and Facebook, and also on our website at media.africa. And don't forget to subscribe on Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts.